Welcome to Managing Uncertainty, a podcast series from the experts at BrightPath discussing global risk, business continuity, and crisis management. Will you be ready to lead your organization through its critical moment?
Hello and welcome to the Managing Uncertainty podcast. This is Brian Strauser, principal and CEO here at BrightPath.
This is Barry Wheeler, consultant at BrightPath.
Today we're going to talk about some mistakes that common mistakes we've seen in the critical moment, in a crisis, during our consulting and professional careers. And we've both been at crisis management for quite some time, almost 30 years for me.
Not quite that long for me.
I have more gray hair.
I'm getting there.
I also have more hair. But what we want to talk about is just we've been inside of a lot of companies, and we've been in a lot of situations on our mm-hmm. own with a lot of different teams across the really around the world. And we want to talk about six or seven common mistakes that we've seen and a little bit about what leads to those mistakes. And I'm just going to start off with the first one for me, a big one, and that is just the overreacting that happens. Mm-hmm. The emotional response in a crisis, particularly a crisis that has personal implications for an individual or for a team, you know, usually where someone's been hurt, or you have this just really extreme reputational situation like a data breach, you know, things are going to have material consequence for your organization or for an individual, and just this emotional response. And this one's particularly near and dear to my heart because I so value emotional intelligence when it comes to folks that work in crisis management,
yeah.
that individuals are able to work through these situations in the moment and, you know, to some extent keep your emotions under control while you're managing the crisis, and then you bring that out and experience it in its full when the crisis is over. And it's such an important thing to me. And I think that we also get there not just through folks who are, you know, have high EQ, high, you know, quotients in this area, but I think we also get there by practicing and having exercises and
yep.
having exercises that are realistic to where people understand their roles and responsibilities and how the team is going to collaborate to make these very difficult decisions. Right.
Well, I mean, it gets back to, you know, the kind of the tried and true methods of fire drills and shelter in place drills. And
why do we practice these things?
You practice those things so that you feel at least somewhat comfortable or knowledgeable or kind of confident in the next two things you're supposed to be doing. And I think a lot of times when we get into these situations, especially kind of as you were describing, what are the really novel type situations that are uncommon, we've never experienced before, have high impact, have high consequence to them. You know, it's easy to get sucked into the, I just need to react. We just need to do something. I need to do something. And the train kind of just leaves the station without any kind of rhyme or reason other than that sense of, oh, we got to do something. Mm-hmm. And it's especially complicated when you have an existing process and you have something in place and you either have leaders or other teams kind of feeling the need to go address it rather than go to the mechanism that you've put in place to really kind of counter that emotional response. You have a kind of a unemotional process put in place to escalate to be able to start working through, to gather the right folks, to start putting the pieces in place to manage it in a way that the organization can feel confident about and those individuals who are having that kind of reaction or who are highly involved can feel confident in.
I think it's particularly frustrating, I think, for teams where you have a relatively mature crisis process in place.
Yep.
Now you're confronted with a crisis that's maybe a little bit of outside of the box, or it's has such material impact on the organization that the executives, instead of valuing the process that you built, skip it and put their own process in place. And now you're outside of all the process safeguards and checklists and muscle memory of roles and responsibility and having the right players at the table and more and more and more.
Or putting players who are involved in the established process into the ad hoc process. And
but the process isn't working the way they expect.
But the process isn't working.
Yeah.
And so it creates confusion or it creates difficulty. And for them trying to work through it or to understand what their expectation, what their role is, because they've been hopefully trained and kind of have, to your point, some muscle memory to that, and then all of a sudden that's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to operate in a completely different way, at least not in a way where they have a frame of reference from.
I think this happens too in a slightly different way that's just as frustrating. And we've talked about this on the podcast before around an active shooter incident that several of us were involved in at a previous employer long before BrightPath existed. But we had an industry-leading crisis process, and we were involved in a pretty significant active shooter situation, turned out to be false alarm, and we had some leaders show up and then try to inject themselves into the process, but they weren't part of the process, right? Mm-hmm. Their organization was actually represented by two other people who were already involved and were already doing the right thing and were and understood the process, and these two folks tried to interject themselves, and you know, I had to spend some time getting them out of the process because they weren't part of it, their organization, and getting them redirected to the right people in their org. So this can happen, you know, either way. You may have a situation where executives throw your process out the window, and that's frustrating. Or you might have a situation where people show up and they're like, "Well, I want to be involved in this," and that's fine. You can be, but you have to work through your organization's rep, which are these two folks over here, the ones who have been trained and have participated in crisis management for years. Work with them.
They have that. And I think the piece that often gets lost when people try and interject themselves in is there's norms established within these mm-hmm. crisis response teams that mm-hmm. your representatives know the culture and know mm-hmm. the norms of that group and how it operates. And for someone new to step in to just insert themselves breaks norms, rubs people the wrong way, becomes yeah. a distraction to the process.
The folks that have been involved know how to escalate. They know how to work with the peer group. They know who to talk to. They know how to surface things without wrecking the process.
Right.
So this is all, we kind of went in some different directions, but the point is that kind of emotional overreaction and not following the defined process here because you've got folks who just don't know the norms.
Yep.
What's the next one?
Lack of transparency in the communication. And that kind of gets into siloing effect of different things or containment of information that might be important for the broader response team to know, the leadership, impacted business operations. Really, it just gets down to a kind of a communications breakdown, but really it's not being transparent. And that could happen right at the beginning when folks know something's going wrong, but they haven't escalated it, or they're only talking about certain pieces of it. Because of either embarrassment or other components of that, or it's during and you're trying to mitigate or split off or be the hero, or it's at the end when we're not sharing back what we've learned or what happened or the nature and the results of what transpired.
One area where this really frustrates me that I know we're careful about how when we teach crisis communications, or we talk about communicating externally from an organization in a crisis, and that is when the team, the internal team at the company having the crisis, finds out what's going on from the media.
Yep.
Because, again, there's not transparency about what's happening, and companies not valuing communicating internally to their employees, to their team, before they communicate externally to community, to clients, to the investment community and other stakeholders. You've got to do both. The messages are a little different, and you got to do one. You very clearly need to do one before the other. It can be 10 minutes before the other,
right?
But you got to let the team hear from leaders directly and not hear from leaders through the local news anchor. That's not a good process to get into.
Well, it comes down to trust and respect. Mm-hmm. And the way that a crisis is communicated and addressed really dictates, to some extent, the success of how that organization recovers from that. Mm-hmm. Because if you have, to your point, the internal team going, "We found out about this for the media, this is all being hidden from us, there's, you know, I can't trust people, they don't trust us, what's going on?" There's conflicting stories. They're not able to go to their family and friends who are asking, like, "Hey, what's going on with that?" And being able to say, "You know what, here's kind of what I can share and what I know, and there's some things I know I can't share." But it just comes down to being able to, they're a part of your organization for a reason, and you should be able to trust them in these situations. I don't want to liken it to a family, but it's a little bit of a, you get into those family crises, you got to be able to kind of trust that grouping of individuals.
Mm-hmm. So another mistake that we see a lot of is just in the response, particularly in a reputational crisis or negative news story of some type, is when the response becomes attacks on that organization or the individual, instead of being about the issue. And so I think this is common in today's world when it comes to political communication, where we're going to attack the other party as opposed to just talking about what the issue is. But I also have seen this in reputational conflict where a company gets attacked over something, and instead of dealing with the issue, they attack the individual and the veracity of the claim and et cetera. And there's certainly a time and place for this. But I see more often than not, this is the response as opposed to let's address the issue at hand.
Yep. Well, it comes down to, again, how you portray yourself, how the organization portrays itself dictates a lot of how people view it and what it is that you stand for and what your values are. And that all gets lost if you go on the offensive against an entity rather than that issue. To be able to attack the issue isn't, there's a time and place for that as part of reputation management. That's a key kind of tool in the tool belt there. But to make it about the entity comes across as personal, and then the situation becomes lost on that conversation stream rather than addressing and coming out the other side of that situation stronger than when you went into it. And that's the ultimate goal in some of this stuff, is to be able to do those things. And that gets lost immediately as soon as you go after an individual.
What's the next one you got on the list?
Escalation breakdown. Common one. And there's a certain level of, I think it's important to remember with this one, there's a certain level of ambiguity to it, or it's a word I'm looking for, discretion that individuals can use and whether or not to escalate. But oftentimes we see, and it isn't just from kind of the person on the front line, the security guard at the front, tech in your operations center, manager in a store, or a manager in a bank or something like that, not escalating it up and trying to handle it themselves. It also comes down from the top down, that there's not a, hey, we have a situation and we're not appropriately putting it kind of back to our original one, back into the process.
Mm-hmm.
But that escalation breakdown really is a symptom of having folks not trained, lack of clarity in how those things should be communicated. A culture that I like to, or that we've kind of shared, is over responding, not overreacting. So making it okay for folks to communicate that stuff out without fear of punishment or being called stupid or something like that they made a mistake doing it, that it's right. Really, it all becomes a coaching and a teachable right. moment rather than a punishment, and creating that environment, because the more the more effectively you're able to triage what's going on,
mm-hmm.
and to give that person either the tips to go address it themselves or to say, yep, you're right, here we go, we're going to kick the process in.
I always tried, I took escalation calls for a Fortune 30 organization for 6 years, almost 6.5 years. And I tried really hard not to kill the messenger.
Right.
I mean, I didn't, I was always cognizant.
Thank you.
You were, yeah, I was going to say, Bray was one of the people that had to call
every once in a while.
But I was trying to remind myself that, like, on the other end of the phone, is somebody that's really, it could be in their first real job. And they didn't really want to be the one that called me at 3 o'clock in the morning, but they had to be the one that called me at 3 o'clock in the morning. And so I always try to be polite in those situations, because I know what it felt like when I was in the other end of that, calling my boss at 3 a.m. about a homicide,
right?
Whatever had gone on in one of my retail locations. But there's definitely, I think there's a message there for leaders that when this stuff gets escalated to you, you need to deal with it rationally and appropriately and not sweep it under the rug and not kill the messenger and take that seriously. I think that the message at the other end of this is also you have to escalate the stuff that you, your company calls for to be escalated. You need to have some clear criteria right. so folks understand this. You know, I went into a client a couple of years ago and as an interim chief security officer, and I asked the general counsel, hey, you know, what do you want to know about when it happens? And he literally had two responses. The first one was, no one's ever asked me that question. I'm not sure. Followed by, well, you'll know what to call and tell me. And I'm like, no, actually, I don't. Like, I want you to tell me what's the stuff that happens that's going to be important to you. He goes, oh, well, here are some things. And he goes, well, what would you add to that list? And I'm like, well, I think you should know about these things. But this raises a question about what do you think other people want to know that you need to know before they ask you about it that has happened? And that led to some fun. Like, what are your peers going to ask about things?
For sure.
That I need to make sure you know before they ask, because they're going to find out through other means. Anyway, you kind of get the idea there.
Don't want them to be the last one to know.
Yeah, you don't want them to be the last one to know off of there. One of the other mistakes that we see a lot, and I can think of some recent examples of this, is just lack of organization on action items in a crisis. I think, you know, if you're the crisis leader and you're facilitating this crisis team meeting, and I can't remember how many times we've seen this one happen, there's a lot of stuff happening, okay? Oh, yeah. And they're facilitating, and they need a note taker. Somebody needs to take notes for them. Because
you need a scribe.
You can't, yeah, somebody's got a scribe. You can't do that and run the thing at the same time. I know I couldn't, and I take pretty good notes. But you also need to delineate, this is some stuff that we have to do. And who's going to do it, right? Which org here at the table does this task belong to because it fits in your area? And if it doesn't fit in somebody's area, then decide as a group where it's going to go. That's why you have this cross-functional kind of crisis organization. But you got to track this stuff.
Yep.
And then you got to stay on top of it. And this is where I think, particularly if your crisis organization is set up correctly, you're not doing everything, but the stuff that can't get solved is coming to you to deal with. Like, here's the right. obstacle or whatever. There's got to be clear paths to resolve this. I remember a specific example of this when in Hurricane Sandy, where FEMA wanted to bring gas and distribute it in retail store parking lots. And I'm like, I can tell you I don't like this idea. But I can also tell you this is not my decision. I will take it to the person whose decision it is. And then, you know, kind of chase down the answer to that question. But that was a problem that, like, the local retail stores weren't going to be able to solve. We had to answer this question for them, right. because it was really a policy question. So you've got to have the mechanisms to escalate those decisions and make those decisions quickly.
Well, I think, you know, we've seen organizations take different approaches with this, too, where, you know, they have kind of online virtual tools that they're tracking these things in real time. We have people who have sheets, paper sheets that they're tracking this information on. The most probably effective one, at least in the moment, excuse me, is a whiteboard. And just using the whiteboard to track as the conversation goes, that scribe is writing down key pieces of information, kind of situational components from the different groups at the table, but then those action items and listing those out and then being able to recap at the end of that kind of conversation or the call of what's next, mm-hmm. what off this list are we going to do?
Yeah. And there's always just a lot to keep track of in these situations. So I think that's a good one. Another example of things that we see pretty commonly, mistakes we see pretty commonly, it's just, and this one just kills me, role ambiguity, uncertainty with roles and expectations within the crisis organization. And I attribute this sometimes to just poor planning or poor training, or more likely, you haven't really done an exercise, a good exercise, where you work a lot of these details out because you've practiced and you've had some lessons learned out of that practicing, so folks are clear on what this is. If I walk into a real crisis and people aren't sure who's in charge and who's taking notes and who's running the meetings and who's communicating the results of those meetings, I'm usually looking at a team that hasn't had an exercise.
Yeah.
A real exercise.
Safe bet.
Safe bet. And it's a really bad place to be because you exercise in order to build that muscle memory and understanding of how you're going to collaborate so that you can do this in a crisis. And now you're in a crisis in UFTA, as we say in Minnesota.
Well, and it gets to the different kind of functional pieces of the crisis team too, that if they don't, you know, team member accountability, for example, if it's an important piece sometimes in these situations, if nobody knows who's responsible for it or teams that are responsible for it, it gets left open.
And by team member accountability, we're talking about actually accounting for your team in some type of life-threatening injury possible situation. Who's doing that and what is your process? Is that local team? Is it corporate HR? Is it the field HR group? I mean, who does it? By the way, and if you think this is just an HR responsibility, you're nuts.
You are sadly incorrect.
Yeah. It's a shared responsibility, but someone's got to be in charge of the darn thing. Team member accountability, obviously, if you're listening, you're picking up on some sarcasm related to this. But part of that is just simply we see this a lot, this team member accountability as a challenge.
So the next item we have on our list, kind of the penultimate one here, but it's really about remembering to not overemphasize the kind of operational and financial impacts of the situation versus the people impacts. A lot of times I think people always know people impacts are the right thing to address first and the important thing to care about there. Doesn't always translate as you get into the conversations about what's going on with the situation. Whatever kind of feels like the hot fire or the passion point of the thing tends to dominate the conversation. In some situations, that is for sure people impact, and that's very clear. For some other situations, that's not always the case, and especially for ones where, you know, they may happen in off hours, or it's kind of a known thing like a hurricane or severe weather where people may not be at the facility, they're at home. But there's still impacts to people. And so it's easy to kind of default into kind of the operational or financial pieces.
Too focused on the business and not enough focused on the team. I really think that the crisis has to start with, is the team okay?
Yep.
What is the impact on the team? And what do we need to do to help them? And then you can get it to the other implications of this. I think it really, just like it does in the public sector, emergency management starts with life-saving rescue operations. Mm-hmm. Here, I think we start by thinking about life safety and then what's the impact been on the team and what do we need to do, you know, to help them through this. I think a lot of companies, when I think back to Hurricane Harvey and Maria and Irma, where, you know, fortunately none of our clients had any loss of life or anything like that, but a lot of companies, like, they knew their team was impacted, right? But their questions were about, well, when can I reopen the office? When can I reopen the store? When can I get the campus reopened? We were working with a university that was impacted at the time. And I kept steering them back to, those are important questions. But you can't do any of that if you don't take care of the team. And the team has evacuated and they have impact. They've lost homes. They've had impact to their homes. They've lost pets in one case. We got to talk about how to deal with that first, and then we'll get to the how do we get these things reopened. Because honestly, your first big impact to address is this stuff with the team. And like we saw companies at the time that didn't have disaster pay in mind for these situations. Like, it was one of the questions I asked before we started some of their crisis calls was, are you going to continue to pay the employees who are out of work? Because it sounds like we're not going to get into some of these buildings for a couple of weeks. Because they're flooded. Are we going to pay these folks? Well, we have an interruption policy, but oh, that only works for 3 days. Okay, well, let's work on solving that issue. Do you want to do this? And then how are you going to do it?
Yep.
Because honestly, we need to solve that before we get to these other problems.
Yep.
And yeah, companies just don't, I don't think they're naturally wired to think that way.
No, and it's, you want to get the storefront open as soon as possible, you know, for lack of a better analogy. you can't really get it open if you don't have anybody working in there,
mm-hmm.
or shopping there or interacting with it like they're supposed to. Because mm-hmm. a lot of times there's people impact that either from a customer base or your client base or partner base too that, yeah, great, you're up and running, but nobody else is.
Right.
No, nobody else is set up. You haven't set up your part of the system to get everybody kind of back online, back on their feet, back able to return to as much of a normalcy as they can get to.
Right. So our last area, our last mistake that we see, and this was kind of funny because we had just asked my wife, who works here at BrightPath, about, you know, what's the big mistake that she's seen companies do. And she's been at this her whole life, longer than I have. And she brought up, as she put it, not having enough coffee available for the team. Mm-hmm. But what she was really getting at yep. was just like not taking care of the team. And by yep. team here, we're talking about the crisis team. The folks that are dealing with, we're leading your company through this situation. And I think we said on multiple podcasts that one of the first things that we always did when activating is to order food, mm-hmm. right? So coffee maker, pizza,
candy.
Have some healthier options available, of course. But feed that, you know, have food available for the team. Team's going to work a lot. They're going to have some odd hours. They're going to want water and caffeine of choice. I know I had somebody that only drank Diet Mountain Dew on the team, and so we always had that in there. I'm a coffee drinker. I will drink coffee any hour of the day in a crisis. So those are the kind of things that
yep.
– but also I think is just being aware – and we talked about this too – being aware of the mental health of your team.
Yep.
And particularly when you're in these like Hurricane Harvey, Irma, Maria, that was like 35, 40 days of a lot of nonstop action for a lot of folks. And we needed to have situations where we were rotating people in and out. Like, hey, you know what? You're going to take the next 2 days off, and you're not going to read your email, and you're not going to answer the phone, and you're not going to participate in the calls. You're going to hand those over to me. I remember having this discussion with one of our folks, yep. and they were like, no, I can't. I mean, we're in the middle of a hurricane. I'm like, yes, and you're burned out.
Yep.
Right. You're headed there and you need to go home. You got little kids. You got a wife. Go be a dad and be a husband and come back on Monday because it'll still be here.
Yep.
It's not going anywhere. I'll work this weekend.
I think in this this one in particular, like, this one is one where not for well, I should make the generalization, but typically I would say organizations don't really want to take advantage of their folks that are responding to these things,
mm-hmm.
but these folks often get taken for granted
mm-hmm.
because the situation is so focused on the incident itself that those responders, the people who are working the issue are often, you know, that's what they do. So they're in it. They're not necessarily going to raise their hand and bow out. They're going to keep working and keep working and go home, sleep, come back and work and work and work rather than take that disconnect, bump up their effectiveness. You know, there's only so long you can operate in one of these situations before you just are burnt out, or you're on overload. And yes, you want to, oftentimes people want to keep working, but to your point earlier, you lose your effectiveness by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You lose the rhythms, the procedures, the thought process, the creative thinking, the, you know, personal interactions with people, that all suffers
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't help the situation the way that these people desperately want it mm-hmm. to by being dedicated to what they're doing.
You lose your ability for the kind of cognitive thought that I think is required to lead in these situations,
mm-hmm.
particularly where you are the leader and a lot is incumbent upon you to see the strategic picture, the full understanding of the situation, and not just the tactical understanding of the situation. And I don't think you can do that when you're fully exhausted.
No.
Right? Mentally and physically, you need rest in order to do that. And rest is different for different people. I require less sleep than most. But I'm even finding that difficult as I get older. But those are the kind of things that I think when we talk about taking care of the team is watching for these things. And, you know, if you want to learn more about that. I think we'll put it in the show notes, but you can look at our podcasts about the Harvard National Preparedness Leadership Program and the ideas of meta leadership and about thinking critically in a crisis, I think are very applicable here, because we are trying to, keep you out of the basement, as they like to say, kind of falling prey to that fight or flight syndrome.
Yep.
But your long-term multi-day crisis situations, it's just critical to make sure the team is taken care of and that folks are getting breaks
and that you're that giving,
get you away from the situation.
And that you're giving them permission to do so. Because a lot of times they go home, go to sleep. It sounds like go home, go to sleep, come back, instead of go home, go to sleep, don't turn on the news.
Yeah.
Don't show up here again until Monday. Don't. You're giving them that order to stay away.
Right.
Find something else to do for 24 to 48 hours.
And as a leader, you need to model that behavior.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you need to be taking your own breaks, doing your own kind of thing. And when you have the right processes and you have the right people, this is easy to do. But also when you have the right people, they're highly motivated to make a difference. And you have to create that environment where, to give permission, you got to create that environment where they can go and do these things. That's it for this edition of the Managing Uncertainty podcast. Hope you enjoyed our recitation of some of the bigger mistakes we see in the critical moment during a crisis that we've learned throughout our careers. We'll be back later this week with another episode of our Brightcast edition of the podcast. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Managing Uncertainty, produced by the experts at BrightPath. To receive notifications of new episodes, join our newsletter at brightpath.com or subscribe through your favorite podcast player, such as iTunes or Google Play. Learn more about the services and trusted advice from BrightPath by visiting brightpath.com. That's BrightPath.com.